In the history of Danny and Amos, there are periods when it is difficult to disentangle their enthusiasm for their ideas from their enthusiasm for each other. The moments before and after the Yom Kippur War appear, in hindsight, less like a natural progression from one idea to the next than two men in love scrambling to find an excuse to be together. They felt they were finished exploring the errors that arose from the rules of thumb people use to evaluate probabilities in any uncertain situation. They'd found decision analysis promising, but ultimately futile. They went back and forth on writing a general interest book about the various ways the human mind deals with uncertainty. For some reason, they could never get beyond a sketchy outline and false starts of a few chapters. After the Yom Kippur War and the ensuing collapse of the public's faith in the judgment of Israeli government officials, they thought that what they really should do was reform the educational system so that future leaders were taught how to think. "We have attempted to teach people to be aware of the pitfalls and fallacies of their own reasoning," they wrote, in a passage for the popular book that never came to be. "We have attempted to teach people at various levels in government, army, etc., but achieved only limited success." Adult minds were too self-deceptive. Children's minds were a different matter. Danny created a course in judgment for elementary school children. Amos briefly taught a similar class to high school students, and they put together a book proposal. "We found these experiences highly encouraging," they wrote. If they could teach Israeli kids how to think, how to detect their own seductive but misleading intuition and to correct for it, who knew where it might lead? Perhaps one day, those children would grow up to see the wisdom of encouraging Henry Kissinger's next efforts to make peace between Israel and Syria. But this, too, they never followed through on. They never went broad. It was as if the temptation to address the public interfered with their interest in each other's minds. Instead, Amos invited Danny to explore the question that had kept Amos interested in psychology. How did people make decisions? One day, Amos just said, "We're finished with judgment. Let's do decision-making," recalled Danny. The distinction between judgment and decision-making appeared as fuzzy as the distinction between judgment and prediction. But to Amos, as to other mathematical psychologists, they were distinct fields of inquiry. A person making a judgment was assigning odds. How likely is it that that guy will be a good NBA player? How risky is that AAA-rated subprime mortgage-backed CDO? Is the shadow on the X-ray cancer? Not every judgment is followed by a decision, but every decision implies some judgment. The field of decision-making explored what people did after they had formed some judgment, after they knew the odds, or thought they knew the odds, or perhaps had judged the odds unknowable. Do I pick that player? Do I buy that CDO? Surgery or chemotherapy? It sought to understand how people acted when faced with risky options. Students of decision-making had more or less given up on real-world investigations and reduced the field to the study of hypothetical gambles, made by subjects in a lab in which the odds were explicitly stated. Hypothetical gambles played the same role in the study of decision-making that the fruit fly played in the study of genetics. They served as proxies for phenomena impossible to isolate in the real world. To introduce Danny to his field, Danny knew nothing about it, Amos gave him an undergraduate textbook on mathematical psychology that he had written with his teacher Clyde Coombs and another Coombs student, Robin Dawes, the researcher who had confidently and incorrectly guessed computer scientist when Danny handed him the Tom W. sketch in Oregon. Then he directed Danny to a very long chapter called Individual Decision-Making. The history of decision theory, the textbook explained to Danny, began in the early 18th century, with dice-rolling French noblemen asking court mathematicians to help them figure out how to gamble. The expected value of a gamble was the sum of its outcomes, each weighted by the probability of its occurring. If someone offers you a coin flip and you win $100 if the coin lands on heads but lose $50 if it lands on tails, the expected value is $100 times 0.5 plus minus $50 times 0.5, or $25. If you follow the rule that you take any bet with a positive expected value, you take the bet. But anyone with eyes could see that people, when they made bets, didn't always act as if they were seeking to maximize their expected value. Gamblers accepted bets with negative expected values. If they didn't, casinos wouldn't exist. And people bought insurance, paying premiums that exceeded their expected losses. If they didn't, insurance companies would have no viable business. Any theory pretending to explain how a rational person should take risks must at least take into account the common human desire to buy insurance and other cases in which people systematically fail to maximize expected value. The major theory of decision-making, Amos's textbook explained, had been published in the 1730s by a Swiss mathematician named Daniel Bernoulli. Bernoulli sought to account a bit better than simple calculations of expected value for how people actually behaved. Let us suppose a pauper happens to acquire a lottery ticket by which he may, with equal probability, win either nothing or 20,000 ducats, he wrote, back when a ducat was a ducat. Will he have to evaluate the worth of the ticket as 10,000 ducats, or would he be acting foolishly if he sold it for 9,000 ducats? To explain why a pauper would prefer 9,000 ducats to a 50-50 chance to win 20,000, Bernoulli resorted to sleight of hand. People didn't maximize value, he said. They maximized utility. What was a person's utility? That odd, off-putting word here meant something like the value a person assigns to money. Well, that depended on how much money the person had to begin with. But a pauper holding a lottery ticket with an expected value of 10,000 ducats would certainly experience greater utility from 9,000 ducats in cash. People will choose whatever they most want is not all that helpful as a theory to predict human behavior. What saved expected utility theory, as it came to be called, from being so general as to be meaningless, were its assumptions about human nature. To his assumption that people making decisions sought to maximize utility, Bernoulli added an assumption that people were risk-averse. Amos's textbook defined risk aversion this way: the more money one has, the less he values each additional increment, or, equivalently, that the utility of any additional dollar diminishes with an increase in capital. You value the second $1,000 you get your hands on a bit less than you do the first $1,000, just as you value the third $1,000 a bit less than the second $1,000. The marginal value of the dollars you give up to buy fire insurance on your house is less than the marginal value of the dollars you lose if your house burns down, which is why, even though the insurance is, strictly speaking, a stupid bet, you buy it. You place less value on the $1,000 you stand to win flipping a coin than you do on the $1,000 already in your bank account that you stand to lose, and so you reject the bet. A pauper places so much value on the first 9,000 ducats he gets his hands on that the risk of not having them overwhelms the temptation to gamble, at favorable odds, for more. This was not to say that real people in the real world behaved as they did because they had the traits Bernoulli ascribed to them, only that the theory seemed to describe some of what people did in the real world with real money. It explained the desire to buy insurance. It distinctly did not explain the human desire to buy a lottery ticket, however. It effectively turned a blind eye to gambling. Odd this, as the search for a theory about how people made risky decisions had started as an attempt to make Frenchmen shrewder gamblers. Amos's text skipped over the long, tortured history of utility theory after Bernoulli all the way to 1944. A Hungarian Jew named John von Neumann and an Austrian anti-Semite named Oskar Morgenstern, both of whom fled Europe for America, somehow came together that year to publish what might be called the Rules of Rationality. A rational person making a decision between risky propositions, for instance, shouldn't violate the von Neumann and Morgenstern transitivity axiom. If he preferred A to B and B to C, then he should prefer A to C. Anyone who preferred A to B and B to C but then turned around and preferred C to A violated expected utility theory. Among the remaining rules, maybe the most critical given what would come, was what von Neumann and Morgenstern called the independence axiom. This rule said that a choice between two gambles shouldn't be changed by the introduction of some irrelevant alternative. For example, you walk into a deli to get a sandwich, and the man behind the counter says he has only roast beef and turkey. You choose turkey. As he makes your sandwich, he looks up and says, "Oh, yeah, I forgot, I have ham." And you say, "Oh, then I'll take the roast beef." Von Neumann and Morgenstern's axiom said, in effect, that you can't be considered rational if you switch from turkey to roast beef just because they found some ham in the back. And really, who would switch? Like the other rules of rationality, the independence axiom seemed reasonable and not obviously contradicted by the way human beings generally behaved. Expected utility theory was just a theory. It didn't pretend to be able to explain or predict everything people did when they faced some risky decision. Danny gleaned its importance not from reading Amos's description of it in the undergraduate textbook, but only from the way Amos spoke of it. This was a sacred thing for Amos, said Danny. Although the theory made no great claim to psychological truth, the textbook Amos had co-authored made it clear that it had been accepted as psychologically true. Pretty much everyone interested in such things, a group that included the entire economics profession, seemed to take it as a fair description of how ordinary people faced with risky alternatives actually went about making choices. That leap of faith had at least one obvious implication for the sort of advice economists gave to political leaders. It tilted everything in the direction of giving people the freedom to choose and leaving markets alone. After all, if people could be counted on to be basically rational, markets could too. Amos had clearly wondered about that, even as a Michigan graduate student. Amos had always had an almost jungle instinct for the vulnerability of other people's ideas. He, of course, knew that people made decisions that the theory would not have predicted. Amos himself had explored how people could be, as the theory assumed they were not, reliably intransitive. As a graduate student in Michigan, he had induced both Harvard undergraduates and convicted murderers in Michigan prisons over and over again to choose gamble A over gamble B, then choose gamble B over gamble C, and then turn around and choose C instead of A. That violated a rule of expected utility theory, and yet Amos had never followed his doubts very far. He saw that people sometimes made mistakes. He did not see anything systematically irrational in the way they made decisions. He hadn't figured out how to bring deep insights about human nature into the mathematical study of human decision-making. By the summer of 1973, Amos was searching for ways to undo the reigning theory of decision-making, just as he and Danny had undone the idea that human judgment followed the precepts of statistical theory. On a trip to Europe with his friend Paul Slovak, he shared his latest thoughts about how to make room, in the world of decision theory, for a messier view of human nature. Amos warns against pitting utility theory versus an alternative model in a direct, head-to-head empirical test, Slovak relayed in a letter to a colleague in September 1973. The problem is that utility theory is so general that it is hard to refute. Our strategy should be to take the offensive in building a case, not against utility theory, but for an alternative conception that brings man's limitations in as a constraint. Amos had at his disposal a connoisseur of man's limitations. He now described Danny as the world's greatest living psychologist. Not that he ever said anything so flattering to Danny directly. Manly reticence was the rule, said Danny. He never fully explained to Danny why he thought to invite him into decision theory, a technical and antiseptic field Danny cared little about and knew less of. But it is hard to believe that Amos was simply looking around for something else they might do together. It's easier to believe that Amos suspected what might happen after he gave Danny his textbook on the subject. That moment has the feel of an old episode of The Three Stooges, when Larry plays Pop Goes the Weasel and triggers Curly into a frenzy of destruction. Danny read Amos's textbook the way he might have read a recipe written in Martian. He decoded it. He had long ago realized that he wasn't a natural applied mathematician, but he could follow the logic of the equations. He knew that he was meant to respect, even revere them. Amos was a member of high standing in the Society of Mathematical Psychologists. That society, in turn, looked down upon much of the rest of psychology. It is a given that people who use mathematics have some glamour, said Danny. It was prestigious because it borrowed the aura of mathematics and because nobody else could understand what was going on there. Danny couldn't escape the growing prestige of math and the social sciences. His remove counted against him, but he didn't really admire decision theory or care about it. He cared why people behaved as they did, and to Danny's way of thinking, the major theory of decision-making did not begin to describe how people made decisions. It must have come as something of a relief to him, as he neared the end of Amos's chapter on expected utility theory, to arrive at the following sentence. Some people, however, remained unconvinced by the axioms. One such person, the textbook went on to say, was Maurice Allais. Allais was a French economist who disliked the self-certainty of American economists. He especially disapproved of the growing tendency in economics, after von Neumann and Morgenstern built their theory, to treat a math model of human behavior as an accurate description of how people made choices. at a convention of economists in 1953, Lay offered what he imagined to be a killer argument against expected utility theory. He asked his audience to imagine their choices in the following two situations. The dollar amounts used by Lay are here multiplied by 10 to account for inflation and capture the feel of his original problem. Situation 1. You must choose between having $5 million for sure or this gamble. 2. An 89% chance of winning $5 million, a 10% chance of winning $25 million, a 1% chance to win zero. Most people who looked at that, apparently including many of the American economists in LA's audience, said, obviously I'll take door number one, the $5 million for sure. They preferred the certainty of being rich to the slim possibility of being even richer. To which LA replied, okay, now consider the second situation. Situation two, you must choose between having 3, an 11% chance of winning $5 million with an 89% chance to win zero, or 4, a 10% chance of winning $25 million with a 90% chance to win zero. Most everyone, including American economists, looked at this choice and said, I'll take number 4. They preferred the slightly lower chance of winning a lot more money. There was nothing wrong with this. On the face of it, both choices felt perfectly sensible. The trouble, as Amos's textbook explained, was that this seemingly innocent pair of preferences is incompatible with utility theory. What was now called the Lay paradox had become the most famous contradiction of expected utility theory. Lay's problem caused even the most cold-blooded American economist to violate the rules of rationality. Amos's Introduction to Mathematical Psychology sketched the controversy and argument that had ensued after Lay posed his paradox. On the American end, the argument was spearheaded by a brilliant American statistician and mathematician named L.J. Jimmy Savage, who had made important contributions to utility theory and who admitted that he, too, had been suckered by Lay into contradicting himself. Savage found an even more complicated way to restate Lay's gambles so that at least a few devotees of expected utility theory, himself included, looked at the second situation and picked option number 3 instead of option number 4. That is, he demonstrated, or thought he had demonstrated, that the Lay paradox was not a paradox at all, and that people behaved just as expected utility predicted they would behave. Amos, along with pretty much everyone else who took an interest in such things, remained dubious. As Danny read up on decision theory, Amos helped him to understand what was important about it and what was not. He just had impeccable taste, said Danny. He knew what the problems were. He knew how to situate himself in the broad field. I didn't have that. What was important, Amos said, were the unresolved puzzles. Amos said, this is the story. This is the game. The game is to solve the Lay paradox. Danny wasn't inclined to see the paradox as a problem of logic. It looked to him more like a quirk in human behavior. I wanted to understand the psychology of what was going on, he said. He sensed that Lay himself hadn't given much thought to why people might choose in a way that violated the major theory of decision-making. But to Danny, the reason seemed obvious: regret. In the first situation, people sensed that they would look back on their decision if it turned out badly and feel they had screwed up. In the second situation, not so much. Anyone who turned down a certain gift of $5 million would experience far more regret if he wound up with nothing than a person who turned down a gamble in which he stood a slight chance of winning $5 million. If people mostly choose option one, it was because they sensed the special pain they would experience if they chose option two and won nothing. Avoiding that pain became a line item on the inner calculation of their expected utility. Regret was the ham in the back of the deli that caused people to switch from turkey to roast beef. Decision theory had approached the seeming contradiction at the heart of the Lay paradox as a technical problem. Danny found that silly. There was no contradiction. There was just psychology. The understanding of any decision had to account not just for the financial consequences, but for the emotional ones, too. Obviously, it is not regret itself that determines decisions, no more than the actual emotional response to consequences ever determines the prior choice of a course of action, Danny wrote to Amos in one of a series of memos on the subject. It is the anticipation of regret that affects decisions, along with the anticipation of other consequences. Danny thought that people anticipated regret and adjusted for it in a way they did not anticipate or adjust for other emotions. "What might have been is an essential component of misery," he wrote to Amos. "There is an asymmetry here because considerations of how much worse things could have been is not a salient factor in human joy and happiness." Happy people did not dwell on some imagined unhappiness the way unhappy people imagined what they might have done differently so that they might be happy. People did not seek to avoid other emotions with the same energy they sought to avoid regret. When they made decisions, people did not seek to maximize utility. They sought to minimize regret. As the starting point for a new theory, it sounded promising. When people asked Amos how he made the big decisions in his life, he often told them that his strategy was to imagine what he would come to regret after he had chosen some option, and to choose the option that would make him feel the least regret. Danny, for his part, personified regret. Danny would resist a change to his airline reservations, even when the change made his life a lot easier, because he imagined the regret he would feel if the change led to some disaster. It's not a stretch to say that Danny anticipating regret. He was perfectly capable of anticipating the regret provoked by events that might never occur and decisions that he might never need to make. Once at a dinner with Amos and their wives, Danny went on at length and with great certainty about his premonition that his son, then still a boy, would one day join the Israeli military, that war would break out, and that his son would be killed. "What were the odds of all that happening?" said Barbara Tversky. "Minuscule, but I couldn't talk him out of it. It was so unpleasant talking with him about these small probabilities that I just gave up." It was as if Danny thought that by anticipating his feelings, he might dull the pain they would inevitably bring.